It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC, and on this week when President Obama gave a very liberal inaugural address and he nominated Mary Jo White, a prosecutor, to head the Securities and Exchange Commission, lest anyone think the Republican Party is slinking away after the reelection, look at some of this week's news. The most popular politician in America, Hillary Clinton, got raked over the coals on national television by Republican after Republican at this week's Benghazi hearings. The governor of Kansas is pushing for no more state income tax for the rich and no more food, rent, or child care tax credits for the poor. The New Mexico legislature has a new bill before it that would ban abortions after rapes. The Virginia legislature crammed through a pro-Republican redistricting map while a Democratic member was away at the inauguration and couldn't vote. A committee on the future of the Republican Party issued its report yesterday calling for better technology, but no changes in the GOP platform. And Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal gave a populist barn burner of a Republican revival speech yesterday, kind of a rebuttal to President Obama's liberal inaugural address. I thought you'd like to hear some of this. Here is about a minute and a half of Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal last night.
We must quit big. We are not the party of big business, big banks, big Wall Street bailouts, big corporate loopholes, or big anything. We must not be the party that simply protects the well-off so they can keep their toys. We've got to be the party that shows all Americans how they can thrive. We're the party whose ideas will help the middle class and help more folks join the middle class. We're a populist party, and we need to make that clear to every voter and every American. Seventh. We've got to focus on real people outside of Washington, D.C., not the lobbyists, not people inside Washington, D.C. We've got to stop competing with Democrats for the job of government manager. We've got to lay out ideas that can unleash the dynamic abilities of the American people. We need an equal opportunity society, one in which government doesn't see its job as picking winners and losers. Now think about this for a minute. Where do you go if you want special favors? Government. Where do you go if you want a tax break? Government. Where do you go if you want a handout today? Government. This must stop. Our government must pursue a level playing field. At present, government is the unleveler of the playing field. These seven ideas, this is a pathway forward for the Republican Party, one that honors our principles, the American people, and by the way, one that will also help us not only to win the argument, but also will help us to win elections.
Republican Governor Bobby Jindal of Louisiana speaking last night. Let's talk to Dave Weigel, national political correspondent from Slate and an MSNBC contributor, about the reset now taking place in both parties. Hi, Dave. Welcome back to WNYC.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And it looks to me like there's a lot of GOP buzz about this Jindal speech this morning. And, of course, he hopes to run for president in 2016. He was both knocking Romney for saying what he called bizarre things, including the 47%, which he mentioned by name. But also, as you heard there, criticizing the GOP is not populist enough and still too connected to big government and big business. Do you have an impression of the unifying ideas behind this speech?
There weren't that many ideas to talk about. It was not to condemn the entire business of speech writing. This wasn't that much different from any other speeches from politicians who want to get attention without proposing anything new. I mean, Jindal's been making this argument since November. He called up Politico.com and gave an exclusive interview to them, saying the same thing, saying enough of big. You know, we're not the party of big anything. We need to stop making stupid comments. I mean, and I often focus on the stupid comments line or bizarre comments line because it's a dodge. I mean, he says that we can't be a party that make gaffes to get us in trouble, but that, not that we should change anything we believe about policy. The reason for getting passing it around, the reason, you know, Todd Akin or Richard Murdoch got in trouble for talking about, you know, abortion cases of rape was because they believe life starts conception and abortion should be banned in all circumstances. Unless the Republican Party changes that position, that is the— that's logical. I mean, I've talked to Republican strategists who say they're going to train people not to make gaffes, and they are unable to explain how the party avoids that mistake without changing that belief system. Same thing with Mitt Romney. He criticizes Mitt Romney's, I'm trying to think of the word. It wasn't a mistaken way. It was just an inarticulate way of talking about the idea of makers and takers. But it's not something Republicans don't agree with. I mean, in this speech and in speeches about Paul Ryan, Republicans have basically been repeating this idea that half the country or more are mooching off the government. We need to stop that, without really having the audacity to say, well, we're going to take some of those benefits away by doing this. This is the thing. Republicans are reformulating a lot of the same words and not coming up with new policies. You're starting to find some Republican kind of opinion leaders complaining about that, because they need to admit one reason they lost the election was because of policies that people did not like.
And yet at the same time, there seems to be an opening to move forward as a result of the election results on perhaps immigration reform. Republicans probably moving off that in enough numbers to get some kind of comprehensive immigration reform. We saw how they gave up the idea of budget brinksmanship over the debt ceiling. So the election does seem to have consequences in terms of the stuck polarization on some things beginning to crack, mostly on the Republican side, do you think?
Well, immigration is promising to a lot of Republicans, because there are members of the party who understand that if they edged up their share of the Hispanic vote, then they would have been able to win a couple of states, and if they do it in the future, they could win the election. And some of them are not convinced they can fix that just by nominating somebody with a Hispanic last name. So you have heard a few senators talk about that. The problem is we need to hear from a preponderance of Republican House members if they're willing to pass this. Remember, the story of the next 2 years is really going to be whether bills that are fairly popular that the president wants whether Republicans can be convinced to allow a vote on that with only about 40 or 50 of them supporting it and most Democrats supporting it. That's likely what most versions of immigration reform look like now. A less comprehensive reform might get the support of most Republicans, but Democrats want more than that. And the only reason we talk about it as something that could happen is because of that pure electoral reason. Whereas with gun control, there are polls showing that certain elements of gun control are incredibly popular. In the past, the gun lobby has been able to finesse that. And for a very long time, getting the NRA's endorsement or losing the NRA's endorsement is incredibly powerful for a Republican member of Congress. I mean, I was talking to Greg Waldman, who runs the Republican campaign committees, a congressman from Eastern Oregon, last week. I was talking to a couple of reporters, actually, and he just pointed out, kind of matter-of-factly, that in 191 districts are safely Republican thanks to all the gerrymanders that they engineered last year.
That's right. In fact, I think that's the most underreported election result from November. It's that more Americans voted for Democrats for the House than voted for Republicans, a big turnaround from the Tea Party sweep in 2010. But the Republicans hardly lost any seats because they were so successful last year in redistricting congressional lines to their advantage.
Yeah, and I've been covering that because it really is determining a lot of what is politically possible. I mean, imagine yourself as one of these three new members from North Carolina, for example, who is only in Congress because the Republicans in North Carolina created a new map that put all of the black voters in a couple of districts and made the rest of the state incredibly Republican. I mean, what is their motivation to bend on anything? The votes for an immigration bill might come from Republicans in Texas. The votes for a gun control bill of any kind probably come from Republicans who represent the suburbs in Philadelphia or in New York or in Illinois. There aren't that many of them, though, and it's the Speaker of the House is still John Boehner. The Majority Leader is still Eric Cantor. What's their motivation? What's their motivation to do any of this without getting hammered from the right? So I think these are the factors to watch. Gerrymandering won't change for a couple of years. The strength of the groups pressuring them is malleable. And I think the NRA kind of falling all over itself and making so many offensive mistakes is probably the best thing Democrats have going for it. It's better for them than the makeup of Congress.
My guest on WNYC is Dave Weigel from Slate, as we talk about meet the new partisanship, same as the old partisanship, to a large degree anyway. In fact, Cokie Roberts said on ABC the other day that while there were 105 swing congressional districts a few elections ago. There are only 35 today. The rest are considered safe for Democrats or Republicans. So should we conclude that bipartisanship, or even the pretense of bipartisanship, is even more dead than it was before the election?
From issue to issue, it's going to change. I mean, I was frankly surprised in the last few months at how few Republicans, apart from, I guess, Jindal just now, pretend that the party doesn't need to do anything except change the messaging. Or how many just don't believe that the party did anything wrong and that this is a fluke election. They believe that in 2008. The belief was that Barack Obama only won because people wanted to vote for a black president and the economy was lousy. This time it really has force them to think about changing at least their image, changing possibly some policy. So, but that's the thing. It's easy to. There's just a lot of good political science on this, frankly, that shows a party out of power has every motivation to block everything that the president or the rest of the party in power wants, because voters might not differentiate between who's responsible for the problem and the fact that there is a problem, and they'll punish the party in power. The motivation for that goes down when a president's reelected and can't run again. I mean, it was a great motivation in 2009 and 10. Remember Mitch McConnell saying his number one goal was to defeat Barack Obama or to make him a one-term president. Mm-hmm. That is gone, so you've got probably 2 years where they're talking amongst themselves, they're thinking about what they might do to make the party more popular. That was what's going to lead them to bipartisanship. And after that, I don't think you see anything. I mean, this is one of the things you'll hear a lot of people in D.C. say is really, you know, Obama has a second term, but he probably has 18 months before a new round of politics kicks in and Republicans stop working with him.
I'm not sure yet what to make of the Mary Jo White appointment or nomination by the president yesterday to head the Securities and Exchange Commission. Here's a clip of the president yesterday talking about her.
You don't want to mess with Mary Jo. As one former SEC chairman said, Mary Jo does not intimidate easily. And that's important because she has a big job ahead of her.
And everyone is saying that she's a former U.S. attorney for New York, so she's there to police the banks, not to encourage them. He appointed a prosecutor, not a banker, to run the SEC. But she was a prosecutor in the 90s, and after that she ran the NASDAQ, and she was a defense lawyer for Wall Street banks, I read. So I wonder if the media is getting this all wrong, Dave.
I don't know. This is somebody that I think Democrats and people concerned with the Wall Street's abuses would have liked in 2009. I think they realize though the SEC chairman's important. The SEC's work was already, I don't think, really disappointing them in a substantive way. They're more concerned probably with allowing, you know, with how Jack Lew is going to behave in the Treasury, whether the Consumer Finance Protection Board is going to be able to operate, because that's actually, Republicans have worked much harder to stop the CFPB than to challenge anything the SEC has done. And the CFPB has been actually, you know, pulling back quite a lot of money in from an industry that was.
And that's the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the Elizabeth Warren brainchild that was so controversial in getting into the Dodd-Frank bill.
Yeah, I just feel in terms of, however you're going to put it, policing Wall Street, being tough on Wall Street, I mean, the SEC is probably not going to change that much. It's whether Jack Lew is somebody with much more of a footing in the progressive world than Tim Geithner is. Richard Cordray has impressed them quite a lot. I think people who are concerned with those issues are going to look more to those agencies and look to whether or not Republicans try to trammel what they're doing. They're generally pretty happy with Mary Jo White. I mean, I think you can find some criticism of her from outside, but you know, in general, there was this little spasm of kind of media created hype about whether Obama was appointing too many white men to the cabinet. In policy terms, they're actually more pleasing. All the choices are more pleasing to liberals than the last crop were.
Let's take a phone call about the Mary Jo White nomination. Tom and Seabright, you're on the air. Hi, Tom.
Yeah. Good morning. How are you?
Okay.
Yeah, I think it's great that he's putting a prosecutor in now, and although she has been a defense attorney for white-collar criminals, but hasn't the statute of limitations run on most of the major crimes that we think Wall Street executives committed to cause this major financial collapse. So they're going to get off scot-free whether she's a tough prosecutor or not.
And the SEC's purview, at least in the past, has only been civil cases, not criminal cases. I did hear, Dave, a report on NPR where there was some speculation that she might try to change that. I don't know if they've got that authority. But what do you think about that and Tom's question?
I mean, I haven't been covering this element of the Obama administration's action quite as close. And there's a lot of attention when new people come in, but there doesn't seem to be much of a shuffle below her in the workforce of the SEC.
Right. So we'll see about those statutes of limitations and how much of a push she makes to change what they have jurisdiction over. Can I get a quick impression from you in terms of what it means for partisanship of the agreement in the Senate yesterday to change the filibuster rules so that it won't take 60% as frequently as before, I guess, to get every little thing passed?
Oh, no, it'll take 60 votes still to break a filibuster. So Democrat reformers lost on what they had been campaigning for 2 years, some of them longer. What it does is, it used to be possible to filibuster most bills three times, and it used to be possible to block nominations simply because the threat that you were going to filibuster them meant that there'd be 30 hours of debate following that. You know, think about that. Try to nominate 10 judges with that threat, and you've got half of a month, basically, given the Senate schedule, overtaken with a couple of nominations. And it just made it impossible to nominate people. You saw this in the huge glut of stalled district court nominations. So they fixed some of that. And what Democrats were telling me yesterday as they voted for this was that had they gone for a more aggressive reform, Republicans would kind of in disbelief because they didn't think Democrats would do it. We're promising to blow up the Senate or make the Senate melt down. By having something that got all but a third of Republicans on board, they just kind of almost crossed their fingers and hoped that that would lead to a new spirit of bipartisanship with Republicans. It's almost like we've used too many hostage metaphors in D.C. recently. But the kind of things, you know, somebody when they've they're in a hostage situation or they'll promise to do anything if you just let them go. Well, they let the Republicans go. They said, okay, we could have changed the rules completely. We'll let you go, and we hope you're very thankful and agree to be as compromising on the next round of nominations as you said you would be. You know, the first test for that comes with this Cordray nomination, which is something this is a CFPB chairman was somebody Obama had to recess appoint because Republicans, frankly, just didn't believe that job should exist. So I asked Democrats, you know, does this move that along? They couldn't really say, but that's going to be the first test of whether this did anything to ameliorate the blocks in the Senate.
Dave Weigel, Slate political reporter and MSNBC contributor, thanks for coming on with us today.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, Governor Cuomo's budget director, Robert Megna. And then for the 40th anniversary of Roe versus Wade, Planned Parenthood plans to stop using the term pro-choice. We'll talk to the head of the Planned Parenthood Federation of America, Cecile Richards, and take your thoughts about that. Stay with us.